Programs will start thinking and the people will stop, stop.
I still don't understand why you want to break the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in for them, I could reconstruct it.
All right, everyone, welcome to the In and Out Show.
Hola, this is VR.
And I am Slip Mode, and we also have JP in the house, which is also known as Spike now.
I'm Spike, and I'm kicking it fresh one time.
Because I nailed him to the wall the other day, so he's just taking that as a little talisman to his new existence.
Awesome. So what have you guys been up to lately? Anything interesting? Anything new?
Actually, I saw the lunar eclipse the other day. That was rather interesting. It was kind of neat to see how similar Mars looked, or the moon looked similar to Mars as it turned its that pale red, and you could see all the asteroid, you know, the meteor craters in it, and all the kind of little cracks. It was kind of neat.
Man, nobody told me about that.
All you have to do is like look up and be aware of your surroundings every once in a while.
What time was it?
Its peak was at 8:13.
Actually, me and VR were looking at it together.
Yeah.
Sounds romantic.
No, we were just looking in the sky, and that was all that was happening at that point.
Okay. There was no, like, you know, big moons available or anything that were ripe and ready.
This is about the time where we're going to get into our stories.
Otherwise, we start digging ourselves a really big hole.
All right. Well, this is our first biweekly show, which is pretty neat because we're going to be bringing the news a lot quicker to you than we used to be.
In an hour than before. As in more in the now.
More in the now. More for you. News for the time we have during this month. I'm sure a lot of people have heard about this, but we're going to comment on it. iTunes, which is basically a software and a service offered by Apple Computing Corporation, their music store actually sold over 1 million songs in their first week. In less than 1 week, we've broken every record and become the largest online music company in the world, said Steve Jobs, Apple CEO. Basically, they sell their songs for 99 cents per song. Their database has over 200,000 songs available. And so it could define the new way to purchase your music.
Well, that's what's really neat is that the internet makes that of that kind of just record blockbusting available. Is that you have this instant access to millions of people that you just go, oh look, I have this product, and you know you can become, you know, do $1 million, you know, over $1 million in sales in your first week. What in what other time period and what other technology has that been possible? None.
You're talking about through the use of the internet, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I don't know, I think it's pretty interesting. I don't know, you know, I'm still the guy that likes to go out and grab the CD and even though there isn't that many CDs I like nowadays and have it on file, but I mean, there's obviously tons of benefits of having your own MP3s and creating your own CDs and, yeah.
Well, there are also programs, and what you can do is, you know, actually print out and produce the original, like, CD cover that you can insert into the CD case, and you can essentially have the exact same thing with the barcode, even, you know, on this thing that you purchased over the internet.
And you can also do, like, we all know, like, we'll go out and get a CD, and we only, like, we get it for one song or two songs, and we listen to it, and the rest is total crap.
Oh yeah.
And then I guess this would be a good way of.
And that's unlimited play for a buck. That sounds pretty good.
No, it's you own it for a buck.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a deal.
And is Apple still? Is there any news that I heard they're making a bid to buy possibly to buy Universal Music, which is the largest record label basically, and Apple is considering buying it.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Well, that could be an interesting little merger now, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be crazy.
Then Apple would finally have a product that sells. No, I really like Macintosh. It's just, or Apple per se, but, yeah. Well, dealing with the Windows market and also dealing with hardware that's way more expensive than the typical Windows hardware just because it's not as widely sold. And I think we talked a little about that in one of the previous shows.
Yeah, but that's all supply and demand factors, really.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. It's not because the hardware is not as good. It's just, yeah, there's more supply and demand for the Intel power PC-based, not power PC, but PC-based machines. All right. I just wanted to get that one out of the way. I thought that'd be a pretty interesting thing to talk about, since it's probably going to be the de facto or pretty soon of music sales online, or people probably copy that idea and do it themselves. All right. I know we've talked a little bit in the past about SCO's, which is a company, SCO Unix, and their complaints about saying that their code has been used for other operating systems, their license code, per se. And they basically want to collect damages or licensing fees for people using that code. This is a little bit of information about a denial of service attack that was executed on their servers on May 2nd. SCO suggests that the Linux community may be responsible for the denial of service attack on its servers that occurred Friday, May 2nd. Right here is basically a response to their to their claims by Eric S. Raymond, and he was one of the, he's the president of the open source initiative, or the GNU initiative. His response is, anyone attempting to take it seriously should note that neither the Linux community nor the wider open source community, of which it is at part, has any past record of such behavior. If we fought our battles in those terms, Windows is a sufficiently vulnerable target that we would have severely hammered much certain larger adversaries long ago. News accounts suggested the machines subverted were into performing the attack were Windows boxes. It would be more responsible to suppose that the attack was not work of anybody from the Linux community, but a Windows-based community cracker underground gang. Not Windows-based community, but Windows-based cracker underground gang that is sympathetic to us and decided to fight for the good guys, in quotations. If that's so, we reject this such misguided assistance. Any program Linux crackers out there should stand down now and refrain from any such offenses in the future. We cannot accept such help and remain the good guys at the same time. Let there be no mistake about this. We in the Linux community do not regard denial of service attacks or any other criminal trespass as a legitimate tactic in disputes. Sustained we are by our shared belief that the open source development model is a better way. We are proud to fight, or we are too proud to fight dirty. It goes on to say a few other statements, but basically goes along the lines that it's not within the open source Linux community's way of doing things, and anybody that attempts to do such and say that they are from that community will be shunned, or if it's somebody from the outside, they're saying, we don't really need your help, thanks anyways.
That is really kind of, there's something else there. I'm just kind of blown away by the whole thing of that, you know, we want everything to be open source. Now let's, you know, destroy everything that's not. You know, it's kind of like this warring factions that these, you know, here's open source or Linux people are this one tribe and Linux users are another tribe. And we're trying to find out in this whole system of who's going to be the survivor and who, you know.
Yeah, you're definitely right. There is, I mean, no one really thought of Windows people as being part of a tribe, but definitely the Linux, because it's a community of people that would openly say, like, all right, I want to be involved in this community, and, you know, it's called a community, you know, and I guess...
Well, you can call it a community, but it's still composed of individuals, and, like, that person can go and deny that the community would do that, and that might be, in, like, the community mindset, but there's still probably individuals who would go and do something like that. I mean, you can't
ascribe
one viewpoint to the entire group of people.
Well, basically, Eric Raymond, who's been around forever, I mean, he's been around doing coding and everything on Unix machines from the early 60s, I think it's the early 60s, or late 60s. He's started the open source movement, or the open source initiative, as it's called. He's developed a whole bunch of the GNU tools, which is under the general... The GNU licensing scheme, which is basically kind of like the GPL and stuff like that, and it's open source code. It's able to be shared, modified, used. That's really helped the open source movement. And so people like him and other people that are known for being a part of the open source movement and one of the huge initiators, you know, producers and stuff like that, I mean, those guys are going to have their comments, and they're going to say that, you know, our core group of people that you could probably define as the open source initiative because based on these reasons that we've, you know, started it or worked in it or whatnot, don't agree with such things. So, I mean, it's going to have to become, you're going to get down to a leader or a group of leaders and stuff like that. Even though there are the individuals, you know, they'll be able to have means of shunning and accepting and whatnot.
See, there's other things in there because there's, like, just having... people who use the Windows operating system, that they all can communicate together and exchange ideas. And people that use Linux and Unix things, you know, they do the same thing. So they're almost in a little organism within themselves. You know, both of those are pretty separate.
Definitely.
But now they can communicate together, but just not very well. Am I right on that or no?
As far as...
like sharing ideas or different software and things like that.
I think there's no generalization of, like, sharing software ideas with people beyond the open source community from people within the open source community. I think they're generally just, like, they don't even think about those other people. I don't really think this is only my guess. I don't really think that the open source people really care or give a crap about what other people do outside of it.
Except that it would work, that their access and their control and their opportunities would expand, you know, essentially exponentially with the growth and the proliferation of more and more people using open source.
Mm-hmm.
And so their resources would grow, their power would grow.
And every once in a while they'll throw in a little, you know, bashing on, you know, what Microsoft, the other big, you know, developer out there is doing wrong.
Right. But see, that's kind of the nifty thing is it would be a perfect world or perfect socialism for everything to be open source. But at the same time, it doesn't have the same kind of, it needs kind of to battle.
It needs the fight.
It needs the fight in order to generate new ideas. And so there needs to be this common balance.
Yeah.
You can both exchange ideas and paradigms and models.
And they've been accused of really not innovating, but just taking from the closed source community more than leading, following, basically.
Who is being accused?
Like, the open source community has been accused of not innovating as much as, say, Microsoft or Apple or some of its...
Actually, I think we've seen and we've talked about other things on the show where...
I've heard the complete opposite. That's why I'm kind of in awe that you said that.
And also, like, Microsoft started from, like, the open source kind of forum, back at 2600 meetings and Apple. Well, Apple did anyway.
Well, here's a brief history, I guess. And I was reading on this one site that basically said how Microsoft didn't innovate anything except for one thing that they did innovate, which was they started out selling QBasic for different computing platforms. And they said that was an innovation. And then after that, it went to buying another DOS-based operating system from somebody else, tweaking it a little bit, selling that, and it was a bunch of crap, stealing the GUI from Apple, which basically got it from Xerox, and then, basically Windows NT was their big thing that they're coming out with for themselves, but the guy that wrote that was one of the main programmers for the VAX Unix operating system. So basically, he just took what they had learned through VAX and built the Windows NT, kernel and a lot of its features, but it had like a lot of broken GUI. It wasn't really well developed. It was like a new server product and stuff like that. So, you know, and Windows 2000 basically is just a fixed version of Windows NT 4.0, and then Windows XP is just this piece of crap that's bloated and has like wizards that could like even take the most common computer user and make them sound like an idiot while they're answering the questions. So, I don't know.
I'm talking about more like modern day, though. Like, I mean, what are the major open source projects right now? Like Linux, Mozilla.
Well, there's quite a few. Like, I think it's not only just the projects, and we can probably discuss a few, but it's probably also the development model and the amount of choice that's given to the user. There's also things to say as far as coding practices, as far as quality of code. Security of code, and also gives you the open-ended option of modifying it and changing it for your liking. There's a few things as far as just like the operating system that, you know, are developed off of old ideas that were innovative of their time and actually are still innovative nowadays and useful from the Unix operating system. So they didn't create that on their own, some of those things, but a lot of those things, there are some things that have been added on top of it as far as the Gen 2 Linux operating system. They have something that is very interesting that's been done in other operating systems, but they have a different little twist on how they do theirs, which is their portage system. I actually just read a review of Gen 2 Linux. I use it myself, and it's kind of the something that appeared out of nowhere not too long ago, and now it's become a large thing as far as the Linux distribution. Their portage system allows... Well, the difference between them and other packaged-based Linux distributions is that their packages are built from the tarball. They're actually built from the source, from the ground up. They give you a system to be able to manage those programs, uninstall them, remove them, update them. They give you a system to easily modify and tweak how those programs are installed. And it's also easy for security reasons because you can also just say check for new packages out there. You can stay on their mailing list and actually figure out what packages are new that have a security bug, fix for a bug, and you can go out and grab it. It's actually a really easy to maintain Linux distribution that's You know, it's really neat. So that's one thing. The Windows managers, actually, they have a few different things and ways of using the Windows manager that aren't shown on other operating systems, the way GNOME works, the way Enlightenment works, the way KDE works and stuff like that, or other Windows managers. They actually have a few techniques that are a little bit cooler, a little bit faster to use than Windows operating system GUI. Their browsers, I don't believe that Internet Explorer allows you to do tabs, where you can...
Nope. How?
That's okay. That won't come through.
That was a strong no.
Tabs are really cool because you can have one browser window, but you can have multiple tabs where you just click these tabs and they actually open up your different pages right there. We could go on for a long
time. Yeah,
there's
plenty of things like I've been using Phoenix a lot, and there's a bunch of stuff in there that I definitely prefer to IE. So I think there's definitely some innovation out there, but on a grander scale as far as like totally redefining your computer usage, I think that's where the comes from.
I think where you're getting at is something that's really, really deep as far as how an operating system is meant to function. And I think that based on, instead of going out and recreating a whole new scheme and a way of looking at things, people are trying to develop towards a way to where people can understand what they're using and other developers can really go in and change. And plus, you know, even to rethink something like that, to do something really innovative, you might even need some innovative hardware just to pull it off. So, like, you know, every operating system has a kernel. I mean, there's always disks, you know, there's file systems, there's devices, there's services that you start, and there's GUIs, and there's, you know, there's prompts, and the common practices of how to use the windowing system, there's commonalities to that. So, I mean, a lot of those ideas were already pre-developed, but I think that...
Well, also, I think a little bit comes from, you know, how we see the real world and how we've learned to analyze the world and differentiate things, and we've kind of taken that and put it into this arena where anything can pretty much go, depending on the physics of how, you know, ones and zeros can turn things on and off. That can actually allow for an infinite amount of possibilities of how things are differentiated and how we build these structures and how we can learn to think and communicate and produce work in this area. But we've kind of limited ourselves because we still want it to work very similarly to how the outside world works. But yet, it still has the possibility to be just beyond or even our imagination yet.
Well, one thing to mention is that with all these, like, with Linux and other operating systems, Linux is pretty functional as a desktop environment now compared to, like the BSD Unixes. Solaris's desktop, their CDE desktop is really limited. I mean, they're meant to be servers, not really desktop environments. So, you know, Linux in itself, the ability, it can be a totally hacked up system where you can have all these different things running in different ways and different programs layered on top of something else and yada, yada, yada. And there's constantly, like, people, if you really stay in tune with what's going on or have a Linux box yourself and you're working on it, modifying it, messing with it, you'll find ways to set things up to actually be really, really quick. So it allows you the tools to actually make it innovative as far as how you use it. I mean, I guess that right there is the innovative idea of itself, that you're able to customize and change and hack things up to really work, you know, work for you. So we just went off on a whole tangent, but it turned out to be pretty good.
Yeah, because how that works is, you know, the more versatility you have, the better you can conform it to how you do things, and therefore it becomes much more efficient for you in doing whatever you want to do. So it becomes a better, you know, piece of technology.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that is a good way of looking at the key difference there, is that it's working for you than, like, trying to...
You having to
bend
work
the
for
software,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because that's what technology means. It's the study of process, so you get, you know, more process from less work. That's really what we always want, because we're a lazy organism. And so you get something that you can tweak and tune, and then you go, all right, and so now I can have to do very little to get the amount of work that I need done to be done.
One thing, too, to quickly end on is saying that one thing that Microsoft can't do that Linux can do indefinitely, I mean, straight out, is for security-wise, you can actually make your Linux box modular to where you can say, I want this installed, I don't want that installed. I want this installed, I don't want that installed. And Microsoft even said for themselves, something that they could do for their server software is to have that ability, but it's pretty much when you install it, you get the whole OS dumped on there. And the one thing you might not have the option of installing is just little things here and there, or the whole, IIS 6.0 or whatever version you're running. So that's another thing, you know, just to say. Well, here's another story we're going to talk about that's basically along the same lines of making something more of what it should be. That's the phone ringing in the background. That's okay. Of what it should be, and basically it's talking about the Xbox. And there's a guy that has been coming out with a book pretty soon that is going to be, I don't know, on the edge of possibly being illegal and possibly not being illegal. The book is called Ban Xbox Hacking Book Selling. Very fast. That's not the, I read the whole title. It's called Xbox, Hacking the Xbox, An Introduction to Reverse Engineering. Sorry about that. I'm all thrown off from that phone call. But it happens. Basically, he hasn't got the book ready to be published just yet. It's being built as we speak. This article is a little old. It's probably done right now and ready to be sold. He's already sold 400 to 500 copies before it was even released. And basically, it's talking about the different modifications for it, how it functions, things he's learned from himself, study of the Xbox, what it can be used for. Basically, he says it's about getting the book out there in principle because he can't find a publisher willing to publish it. He says he thinks it's controversial, but it's not illegal. And basically, with an Xbox, if you buy an Xbox, if you had a mod chip installed, you can run everything from a virtual jukebox to the Linux operating system and also pirated copies of Xbox games. He's dug into his pockets to come out and print out at least 1,000 books. And he's selling them off his website. I don't have the link here, but if you search for Hacking the Xbox book on Google, just say the word book after that, you'll probably find it. I think it'd be really neat to come out with information. And we've talked about him before. He's actually, I forget where it was, he discovered the key, I believe, that's used to encrypt the traffic from the BIOS to the machine. I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and look at it, but he's done quite a bit of work. You guys going to jump in any time? You can say anything about that?
It's a pretty cheap machine right there. How much does it cost right now for a new Xbox?
I'm not sure, but you can
actually, they just dropped it.
You can build a modded Xbox with Linux and everything on it for $336.
Wow, that's a really cheap computer.
Yeah.
Well, and also I have some friends that are working on getting even better deals on Xboxes and games like that.
Oh, yeah. I talked to that friend.
Yeah, he's kind of nifty. So eventually I'll tell you where you can find those.
All right.
And we might actually have a sponsor for this show. Wouldn't that be nifty?
Yeah.
That'd be great, and we'd get a free Coke.
That's
even though
it.
Pepsi was a sponsor. Really hated us.
But, yeah, we've talked about the Xbox time and time again as far as being a good computer. It's basically a Celeron 700. I believe it's 128 megs of RAM, 20 gigabyte hard drive, Ethernet card. It's not bad for $336 running an operating system.
How much is a Windows PC from, like, Walmart or whatever?
Like, around $400, I think.
Oh, really?
$400 or cheaper. Well, without a monitor. So with the Xbox, you can actually use your monitor as your television.
That's even better because I have a huge television, so I could just be completely immersed in all my web surfing activities and be really engrossed or disgusted, whichever.
Well, there's actually a front end to the Xbox. I forget the name of it, but there's a front end that somebody wrote that basically, well, there's a guy that had an Xbox installed in his car and he had a television, and he could choose either to get on the computer, play a list of MP3s from like a kind of like a jukebox type software, or you can basically play an Xbox game.
That's an incredible versatile machine.
And that's eventually what I think the Xbox was going to build itself into, was the home...
Complete entertainment system,
yeah. So people have already made that ahead of time, I'm sure, that...
Yeah, that they just weren't tooled up for it already, or they weren't ready to to propagate that.
Or society wasn't ready for it just yet.
You know what I saw? It's really stupid. At Walmart, they have, I believe it was RCA, I can't remember, but there was one brand of TVs that all the boxes for that TV said, Xbox Ready TV, with special Xbox like input or something like that. And I was like, you have to give me a break. Xbox Ready TV. Like, any TV can play Xbox.
That's yeah, but it's probably just so much easier to plug into its little special ports than are like any other port.
Aesthetic.
Huh. Yeah, I don't...
Well, yeah, there are some TVs, because like how I have my DVD player plugged into my TV, I have to go into like the menu settings for the TV and change where it gets its input from.
Yeah, that's standard everywhere.
Well, yeah, but usually there's like a button on the remote that's just one button.
Yeah, I have a button like that on my remote.
Yeah, but like I already have so much other stuff going through it that I had to install the DVD player into these weird auxiliary plugs that were all...
I made my own auxiliary plug system.
Ooh, aren't you special?
For Radio Shack, and it actually costs as much as getting a professionally built one. But it was fun, and I did it, so... Awesome. So yeah, I'd say keep hacking the Xbox and doing interesting stuff like that, and be careful what you talk about, because as we spoke before, you can probably get in a lot of trouble, which... As we've said before, that's a bunch of crap.
Say it again, brother.
That's a bunch of crap.
Oh, hallelujah.
we're going to go into our spam section here. We don't have a
spam section.
There's actually so much spam stories that we've been talking about, and I compiled a few here because this is a huge problem, and it's a bunch of crap. I thought we'd put it together and talk about these all in order. The government's been starting to crack down on spam. ISPs have been starting to crack down on spam. And spam people have been trying to do more spam.
And Hawaii loves spam. Did you know that? That state is one of the largest consumers of spam anywhere. I don't understand.
Maybe they have, like, high, like, unemployment rate and everyone's spamming to keep themselves...
He's talking about the food product.
Oh,
and also, there's a spam museum. You can buy spam paraphernalia.
All right. Just another reason for me to go to Hawaii.
I don't think, actually, the museum's in Hawaii. Yeah, I think it's back east somewhere.
Basically, the government's actually trying to come out with more laws to begin with, to crack down on spam. New rules to curb the unwanted and unsolicited email should be enforced by the end of October, according to a junior industry minister. Basically, they're talking with the computer industry as a whole, you know, certain portions of it that would be inept of what to do about spam. They're trying to listen to what they have to say as recommendations go, trying to see what can be legally done. Basically, spam accounts for as much as 40% of the global email traffic.
That's immense.
Yeah.
That's sad.
And here at this time where we're trying to crack down on, you know, the few phone solicitors that you get at, you know, like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and yet 40% of the world's email...
I know. Imagine if that was 40% of your phone calls.
Oh, that would drive me nuts.
I would have to...
I would just be like, I'm done with the phone system.
You know what I have noticed, though? I've never gotten spam, a soliciting phone call on my cell phone. Never gotten. Have you guys ever gotten one?
Yeah, I've gotten
some. It's illegal, but...
You've gotten some?
Uh-huh.
Or that's because you signed up for a bunch of weird stuff.
That's right. Actually, I was just offered a trip to Orlando, Florida.
Wow. I'll be in Florida for Memorial Day weekend.
That was like $199, and you get hotel and tickets to theme parks and all this other stuff. But you
had
to
Marriott and them that one of the cruise lines? Is that one of the people that...
No, it actually wasn't one of the cruise lines.
Oh, okay.
It was just for you to go stay at their hotel and go to the theme parks, but you had to use it within the year. So I was like, I can't guarantee that I'm going to go to Florida in the next year or so.
Dude, even if it was a great offer, I would never take a deal that I got through a solicitor phone call.
Yeah, I definitely just, as soon as I hear those things, I just want to turn it off. Like, I just don't want to read it, the email. I don't want to hear the phone conversation, I just hang up.
Oh, sometimes they're rather fun, especially when I'm lonely.
Wow. Something you want to share with us, Pierre?
Yeah, that I signed up for. All
right, shared on the show. Basically, going off into what we talked about last month, we talked about how AOL is setting up a lawsuit to sue people that do mail spamming, but they didn't have any names yet put in the lawsuit. This is a lawsuit by Earthlink, and they were awarded $16 million over this one guy that was doing spam. A federal judge awarded the internet service provider Earthlink damages for $16.4 million Wednesday, which was 5-7, I believe, early this month, and permanent injunction against Buffalo, New York-based sender of junk email. The guy's name was Howard Carmack. He's identified as the leader of a ring that used Earthlink services to send some 825 million pieces of unsolicited spam email in the past year. He's basically banned from sending spam or helping others send it. Carmack and others kept the bulk email flowing through internet accounts open with stolen identities and credit card numbers. Basically, a few times he actually, through the spamming, they either put by fake email addresses, which he changed quite rapidly so people couldn't try to find out how he got those email addresses and eventually track them down. And amongst the, well, this is another case done by America Online. America Online also sued for prolific spammers, winning in $6.9 million in a judgment based in a federal court in Virginia in December. In that case, AOL sued a now-defunct company based in Rockford, Illinois, for sending pornographic spam. AOL has won 25 spam-related lawsuits against more than 100 companies and individuals, but they're still still waiting to collect on any of that money. So they won, but they're not getting any money out of it. Good thing is the company is defunct, and probably somebody else will fall in that company's place, and we're back to square one.
Well, looks like at least something is being done, like we're moving in the right direction. So finally people are getting sick of it. So.
Yeah, there's definitely more pressure on the spammers, and the spammers are getting a lot smarter.
What's sad is that they've already made a bunch of money from it. I wish like they could go back and sue every spammer everywhere for every penny they ever made and that it take it away from them. That they will never have benefited from destroying our lives.
Well, as long as these lawsuits keep winning, there won't be any money in the future for spam. And so until there is no money in spam, then spam's going to keep happening.
Or they'll eventually get to a point to where they're doing regulated spam.
Wow.
Where you become, you know, where they try to put, like, the National Do Not Callers list.
Yeah.
Something like that.
National... Yeah, but the thing is, you can change your email so much that, like, every time you change your email, you'd have to resubmit to that.
Yeah.
Not to mention
overseas spam, which you can get around by blocking, you know.
Yeah, or they don't have any laws against it. And
right.
You just
and
go
it can
for
just
it.
Come from an overseas server and get away with it all. But now, why do they call it spam? Is it just because when you look at the spam on the shelf, it looks good, and then you open it up and you taste it, and it tastes bad? Is that kind of where
good question.
It goes to?
I don't know what the
where
origin
like
of the term is.
Spam in the email, it looks good. Ooh, wow, that looks like a great offer. And then you open it up, and oh, that sucks. That leaves a foul taste in my mouth, just like spam.
I think it's like spam. Neither one of them is actually real. They're both artificial impersonations of something that you would want.
Well, spam, the meat product, because it is actually a meat product. It's just a combination of all different types of meat and parts of animals.
It's just wrong. Kind of like spam email.
Kind of like a freak of nature.
Yeah. It's just you don't really want to have anything to do with it. I'll just speak for myself here. I'm not speaking for Hawaii.
Okay. As long as we don't offend any of our maybe like potential listeners in Hawaii.
We're awfully sensitive to Hawaiians this evening.
Mahalo.
All right. Just to go off into a little bit more information about how these spammers are basically, and people doing other ways of getting advertisements and I would call it junk in your face. Brian Schuster, basically a longtime figure in the internet pornography world and also in the world of sending information to your computer without you wanting it. has basically been trying to apply a few patents that he's been developing or that he's sent in over the last few years, or even new patents, and even actually asking that people that are using those technologies apply for licensing and ante up, because he was the original inventor of a lot of these things, I guess. I'm not really going to go into that portion of the article. I'm going to talk about some of the things he has patented, which are quite nasty, and maybe, you know, I'm thinking that most of these work on the Internet Explorer browser. I'm just guessing here, but...
this is all hypothetical.
Well, just that portion of it only working on Internet Explorer, because I know a lot of things that would work on Internet Explorer in one way don't work on other browsers the exact same way, and actually has been helpful in not getting some of those things running on my machine. One of the patents is explicit. It says, describing computer code that can interact with the browser to modify or control one or more of the browser's functions so that the user is directed to a pre-designated site or page instead of accessing the site or page typically associated with the selected browser's function. So when it goes in and basically can control certain aspects of your browser, maybe something where you try to disable something and it automatically enables it, changes your home page and things like that. One of his other patents...
Doesn't that sound like really similar to, you know, defacing a website?
No, because defacing is actually defacing a website.
You're going in there, you're changing your...
Not the website, but your home page.
But your settings in your computer, it's kind of like a hack.
Well, it's like a hack, but it's not defacing.
Well, whatever. It's going in there, changing stuff on you.
It's messing with your stuff.
That's right.
That's a bunch of crap.
Because that makes me go into an autistic little fit.
I'm going to actually develop a poster. It's going to say, in the now, and it's going to show me, and I'm going to be saying, that's a bunch of crap. other Schuster patents include similar technology to take over the control of users' computer and sending them to unexpected websites. One called Method Apparatus and System for Directing Access describes the use of hidden frames to inject JavaScript onto an unsuspecting user's computer, which can later be used to send the browser to another website. It's kind of funny because it actually talks about something that happened to a relative of his. It says the computer of a relative of his was recently hijacked and continually sent to a porn website, Smith said, which is part of the guy who wrote the article. The software that turned the porn site into the browser's default homepage and search page, the computer's registry was also changed so that at any time a less-than-complete internet address was typed into the browser's address field, the server was redirected to a porn site. So instead of saying, like, www.yoursite.com, if you didn't put in the http://, before that, it would actually redirect you to another site. And then the last bit, which I read, which is really nasty, which really sucks, Schuster is continuing to develop new aggressive advertising techniques. One of them would force web surfers to hear an ad from start to finish with no way from the listener to turn the ad off. Or as the patent application states, the website then delivers the audio advertisement into the user via the network in a form that precludes the user from controlling the manner of playback and the audio advertisement.
Gotta love that rephrasing.
Isn't there? There's always one way to turn it off.
Power button, for sure.
That's right.
But why should you turn off your computer?
Exactly.
Because now you are having a denial of service.
Yeah, that sounds like a hacker attack.
Which is illegal. So, if anybody wants, try to find down Brian Schuster and send him all your spam and all your thoughts about his technologies and things that he's created. And that's going to be our piece of crap for the month, Brian Schuster.
Crap of the month.
Crap of the month.
I like his, you didn't read, but his, the description in his patent of the thing that basically hijacked your browser, the description in the patent was something like, precludes the browser from operating in the manner normally expected by the user. Something like that. That's a nice way of saying that he's screwing you over.
Which is basically...
He's taking over your machine and your, you know, your paid-for device and making it work for him.
You know, life's always ugly on the frontier. Like, back in the days, and the 1849ers went out there, there's a bunch of people ripping them off, trying to take all their gold for, like, a mug of wine or mug of beer or something like that. Same thing on the internet these days. Like, that's the frontier, and that's where they're getting away a bunch of garbage until one day when it becomes regulated.
Yeah, but the difference is they get a lot more money out of it.
Yeah.
They made a lot of money back in the day, ripping off the 49ers and such. That's just one example, but pretty much anywhere you go, that's new. Some people are going to be taking advantage of it.
Except you're doing it while sitting on your butt in a reclining chair.
That's true.
With your ergonomic keyboard and desk.
Yeah, it's whoever is the smartest, not the strongest, is taking, or the more manipulative.
The less inclined to be limited by morality.
There we go. Well, that's a good little description there.
Sweet. So, yeah. Spam is bad, and spammers are worse.
That's right.
All right. Yeah, I guess, I don't know, I try to think of something really intelligent to say about spamming, but it's such an unintelligent operation. Send a bunch of crap to someone, some idiot's going to click on it, you eventually make money. That's it. And the only way to stop it is to...
Not click on it.
That's right. I mean, who are these people that I want to slap upside the head that are actually making these people think, you know, give them their 10% of business out of their, you know...
10%, it's like one half of a tenth of a percent. Yeah, and who are those idiots? Seriously, I would like to slap them upside the head pretty
much. It just really makes me want to start spamming, because it's like, you know, there must be enough people out there that you send them anything and they're going to click on it and buy it. So that's great.
That's not great, because then you do the after effects of spamming all those people that don't want to click on it and don't want to buy it.
Yeah, and all they have to do is not click on it.
That's right.
So it is, you know, it's your liberty to go out there and... You know, click on stuff if you want to click on it, or not click on it. That's your choice as a human organism, you know, participating in the cyberspace.
I know Spike has seen The Matrix.
Oh, yeah.
You haven't seen The Matrix yet?
No, I have not.
It's too bad. I'm sure he'd have, like, a mouthful to say about it.
Yeah, we'll probably talk about that next time.
Because
then I'll just be itching. I'll have a fire under me.
Well, it's kind of neat, because I noticed in... The Matrix Reloaded, that they actually used when they were trying to hack, they actually used Nmap, which is a port scanning software. And they used Nmap and basically found that SSH was running on their host, which is secure shell. It's basically a way of getting a shell on another machine. And then they used an exploit, a real exploit, for SSH version 1. To get root on that host. Now, I thought that was damn cool, because that's actually more realistic way of doing it, instead of like seeing like these things that pop up and they're like, you know, secure FBI database, try password, and some guy types 5 passwords and he's automatically in, and all of a sudden like 8 windows show up and it's automatically to the information that you want to see, you know, instantaneously. I thought that was really neat that they actually used that. It seems like
it was pretty cool, and they got a lot of recognition for it online. Like a bunch of people were saying, ooh, wow, it's cool that they did that. So it paid off for them to be realistic for once.
Yeah,
oh, really?
I'm really annoyed that all the passwords that have ever been used in any movie have always come from the middle line of the keyboard. Their fingers never it's always in the just first line.
It's always what's funny about not only, like, film, but also, like, most journalism, is the thing that you know a lot about is what you read about, and then you realize it's totally false. It just makes you realize that pretty much everything they're saying is totally false. Like, for example, if I know a lot about video games, any representation I see in movies or TV about video games, like, it's always that theme song from Donkey Kong, and they're playing with the wrong controller or something, and they're just saying something
or they have it so infuriating.
Which, like, I don't know anything about camping, so I always think that they must be portraying it really realistically.
No, most of the time they don't know what's going on either.
Yeah. Or it's like it shows like a Super NES, but they're playing like Atari sounds.
Exactly, yeah.
That's pretty funny.
They're talking about getting the purple key to the red dinosaur or something, Steven.
Well, the next show, I actually was thinking about doing it this show, but then I was thinking that, not a lot of people have probably seen The Matrix. I think we should do our review of The Matrix on the next show.
I'm up for that.
Okay, that's good. So I've got a lot of things that
I want to see it again, too, before then. So.
The what?
I said I'll probably see it again, also.
Yeah.
Or maybe we might have to go for make a night of it and just all of us go out and do it.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Because there's a lot of things that I've heard people ask, and like, hey, you know, what's this? And I've come up with some pretty good ideas of what it is. So, you know, I think we'll have some pretty good info to discuss those. So we'll do that later on the next show when more people have watched it and we're not giving anything away. All right. Just about wrapping it up here pretty soon. The South Korean group sues Microsoft over the Slammer Worm. So this is really interesting. This is actually somebody finally suing Microsoft for maybe bad programming examples or whatnot, but basically what had happened to their systems during that time made them lose a lot of money, and I'm pretty upset about it.
Right on. Accountability rocks.
In a sign of users' increasing frustration with the security shortcomings of many software applications, a civic group in South Korea has made good on their threat to file a lawsuit against Microsoft Corp's Korean subsidiary, or Korean ISP, and country's information ministry. The suit is directed as a result of the havoc caused by the SQL Slammer worm in January. The worm infected 1,000 machines over the world running Microsoft SQL Server 2000 software. But it hit South Korea particularly hard. Some ISPs in the country were knocked offline for extended periods of time thanks to huge amounts of network traffic generated by the worm. Damage of the U.S. was mostly limited to smaller network outages, but at least one bank's ATM machines were affected, as was the 911 system in one locality. The action is predicated on the country's Product Liability Act, which enables consumers to sue for damage resulting from products. There is some question, however, as whether the software qualifies as a product under the terms of that law. So that's sue their pants off. That's going to be interesting. You know, and software accountability is actually hard because, you know, there's bugs. There's bugs everywhere. But
imagine that. I was just kind of thinking that, you know, that we're really only having to go to war with the Middle Eastern countries is because they don't have computers. But not their whole system is computerized or anything like that. It's, you know, a group of people could actually, you know, like, you know, whoever did, a group of guys could get together and essentially take down a country from their living room just by their computers. And they could do it as, you know, the whole...
I don't think you could take down a country.
Oh, you could probably come pretty close.
I don't... What is
there to be really good?
I don't think that's possible.
You could do a lot of damage.
The internet's basically set up to withstand a nuclear blast. So I don't understand. As far as taking down, what do you mean? What is your description of taking down?
I'm saying lock out their whole banking, you know, system, their power grid, pretty much everything that you'd want to take out in a war. You could probably take out of most industrial countries.
I don't think you'd access the power grid through the internet.
Oh, you might be able to. It could be rather difficult, but
I don't.
You might actually have to be there too, but you don't even have to destroy
premises.
But you wouldn't have to destroy actually anything.
Any infrastructure. Just
I actually think the internet's a little tougher than that. I think it's pretty hard to take out the internet as a whole.
I did shoot at the internet once, and it was not damaged.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, people took out the name servers, that slowed down, you know, name resolution. People have, like, you know, messed with certain servers per se, but no one's taken down the internet. They may have slowed portions of it down, and it may just be your internet, our internet, but it may not be other internets that are actually provided, that are on a subsystem or another system other than our system, where information is being sent for companies and different government municipalities and stuff like that. They have systems that are actually on other internets that provide information and service.
Yeah, but most of those are rather passive attacks. That they're just kind of, they send off, like, their one little thing that does, you know, does one thing. But imagine having, you know, a rather large group of people that their whole, they were completely dedicated to taking out or shutting down everything in one country.
Yeah, like take the SQL Slammer, for instance. That was just an accident, right? Wasn't it? Or it was...
Nobody knows.
All it did was take over the machine and basically hijack it to send out packets, right? But people were like, imagine if that had been intentionally more destructive, like changing around ports, trying to cause damage, changing the way it was operating. Like, that did a whole bunch of damage without even being really that amazing.
But it didn't affect our infrastructure as far as, like, day-to-day. Like, because I lost my internet for a whole week because of some crap that happened at the ISP. Outside of a hacker, anyways, I didn't have the internet, but I was still able to go drive to places and fill up my car and still get food. I didn't need the internet. I didn't need it. Now, if it was my company that, you know, makes my bread and butter, you know, that was on the internet, then I might have a problem.
Well, see, now, if you took down their, like... the gas stations that their accounting system used and got into their
computer. I think they're on dial-up.
Anyway, you could still, you know, hack into their server and then give them a virus to shut them down, so then they can't do anything, which then, when that gets hooked up to their register, shuts their registers down, so they can't ring anything up, which then also, at the same time, is shutting down the whole logistics system for where for the company that they're getting their gas from, so the drivers don't know where they're going, and so at the same time, as you're shutting down the company that, you know, so nobody can get any gas, so the bread and butter company,
all right,
Joe can't do it.
And so Joe can't get his check. And I know, but I'm saying that most likely that's not going to ever happen. And if it does, it might be to one system. It's not going to be to all the systems. And then, in order to do that anyways, that's like a collaboration on like a level of how they collaborated the war in Iraq, you know. I don't see how you could...
That's what I was talking about, a whole group of people that got together. That was their goal, their mission.
Well, maybe since governments are now starting to sponsor stuff like that, maybe in some degree that there'll be, like, mass, like, you know, crap like that that could happen in the future. But then all we got to do is just cut the line that goes from us to them and say, clip, and then we all have our internet that works inside the United States, and we're just like, all right, buddy, we don't need you anymore. We don't need Korean websites, you know. We don't need Russian websites. You guys can go and have fun with yourselves.
Yeah, but all that takes is somebody then flying over here, getting a residence and doing the exact same thing.
Well, that would have to be a lot of residences.
Yeah, then they could.
Then we'll finally close our borders and kick everyone the hell out. And
this will be a very desolate, you know, uninhabited region.
Not really, because we have a lot of reasons.
No, there would be.
We're pretty far off on the tangent right now.
Well, because you would get down to like the show Survivor, is everybody would start voting everybody
all right,
else
if it happens,
off, and there would be one
all right,
person.
If it left. Happens, we'll be able to deal with it. Put it that way.
That's right, because we're adaptable.
Personally, I think we should just get all the white guys out right now
and dedicated.
Stop the problem ahead of time.
Twisted logic. All right. We're getting close to the end of the show. Basically, two other small things to add. Microsoft's pushing for more or for technology that basically puts controls inside of the actual hardware to stop what you're doing and controlling various aspects of your computing experience.
You know what? I don't really play video games on my computer. I don't see myself needing another computer until something else comes along that I need it for. I can play MP3s. I can do my Microsoft Word documents, pretty much get browse the internet. I'm not going to be needing to buy a computer with digital rights management in it.
Yeah, definitely. And then on top of it, it's another small article here.
But you would if it worked on the Xbox and it was your home entertainment system.
What Spike is saying is that he doesn't need their crap.
That's pretty much what I'm saying.
All right.
And then also to say real quickly that
Spike's all about Devo.
All about what?
Devo, de-evolution.
Yes,
also
I am.
Also a weird reference to an 80s rock band.
Whip it good. Basically, this is another article about is there any reason to buy Microsoft anymore? And basically, I'll just cover it really quickly here, as in saying that... No.
I think it's done.
No. There's alternative desktops. There's alternative servers. We've given plenty of reasons here. Go try. Try and do this. Try to get, if you have a second PC in the house, or just dual boot or something like that, I would like you to get everything you have and make it all running in Linux and use it all in Linux and a Linux desktop. Or you know, try OS X, which is another good operating system. And definitely do that. I'm pretty sure that you'll find, unless you have a lot of outdated stuff, if it's newer stuff in the last like 4 or 5 years, we'll say 4 or 5 years, we'll say that most likely I would say that 85% of that stuff is going to work just fine on your machine. And as Linux and other operating systems develop, a lot of stuff will work even better, or there'll be a wider range of things that will work. So definitely try that out. Run a Linux server, see what it's like, see if you like it or not. And hey, if you got a lot of money and you feel like sparing some, go out and contribute to some of the open source community funds that they have out there to support the programmers. I mean, we're using it for free, but I try to do what I can to push the initiative, and you can also donate money if you'd like. That's going to be it for this. This is our mid-May In the Now show, and we're going to be back in 2 weeks talking about more things. So stay tuned. This is Slip Mode signing out.
This is Spike saying to our Hawaii listeners, aloha, and to everyone else, get lost.
This is VR saying later.
All right, we'll see you guys next month.